Thank you so much to the UDIA for the opportunity to speak to you today. Now, I'd originally been invited to the same Congress 2 years ago, but the event was cancelled for some fairly obvious reasons. And suffice to say, the talk I'm giving today is very different from the one I'd written and planned to give in March 2020. 2 years of pandemic and ongoing recovery have profoundly affected every aspect of how we live and work, but few more so than our housing choices. In fact, things have changed so much on this front that the focus of my talk is almost solely on the drivers of housing outcomes. There is just that much to talk about. I won't have anything to add about monetary policy today beyond what's already been published in recent weeks. I know that's probably a disappointment to some of the audience. And to be honest, I'm not going to say that much about the price of established homes. Rather, I plan to focus on some of the underlying drivers of housing demand, their likely persistence, and the capacity of the construction industry to meet that demand. Now, it's no surprise that the pandemic has changed the way we think about our homes. There is nothing quite like being confined to your home for months on end to make you appreciate having a home that meets your needs, or to rankle at one that does not. Spurred by the experience of lockdown and self-isolation, many people understandably wanted a bit more space, and perhaps a garden. Some also needed space where they could work, or perhaps just fewer flatmates to share that space with. This shift to wanting more space has changed many people's living arrangements. The full extent of how much it's changed will be revealed in the 2021 census results that will be released from late June. But until then, we have some intriguing and suggestive results from survey data. And these show that average household size has fallen since the pandemic began. The share of group households, flatmates, declined in 2020 and has remained at this lower level. By contrast, while some young adults moved back in with their parents at the onset of the pandemic, that shift has since reversed. On the question of who you would rather be locked down with, at least some Australians have voted with their removalist fan by moving out of their share house and in with their partner. The decline in average household size increased the demand for the number of homes. And this helps explain why rental vacancy rates quickly returned to low levels, even though the international border was closed and population growth declined to be close to zero. Now, I'm going to do a little calculation here. Very roughly speaking, the decline in population growth translates into up to, but probably no more than, 200,000 households that didn't arrive in Australia who would have arrived if population growth had stayed where it was before the pandemic. Up to 200,000, but no more than that. Now, across the whole Australian population of more than 25 million people, a decline in average household size of the extent shown here in this graph would add around 140,000 households. Now, this is necessarily a rough calculation, and as I said, we will know more when the census results are out. But in very broad terms, though, these two factors roughly offset each other. And this suggests that the number of homes demanded didn't change that much throughout the pandemic. Now, there's a broader point to be made here, and that is that things always adjust. If average household size hadn't declined like this, there would have been fewer households to fill the new homes being built. But instead of the result being a swathe of empty homes, prices would have adjusted, in this case, rents. This would have induced the demand needed to match the supply. I'm reminded of all those predictions that population ageing would result in a shrinking labour force. because people aged over 65 are less likely than younger people to be employed. But as I've noted in the past, participation of older workers and female workers in most age groups increased, and that more than offset the effect of ageing. The lesson here is we shouldn't focus only on the original shock. We should consider how people react to that shock. So people's housing choices have changed over the past 2 years. Homes with some outdoor space became even more attractive relative to small apartments. And this shift in preferences was evident in both rental and purchase markets. Rents and prices of apartments weakened relative to those for detached houses during that early phase of the pandemic, and especially in the larger cities. Renovation activity also increased. Now, the desire for more space is one thing. The ability to get it is another. For some, this choice became more feasible due to other pandemic-related shifts. As I first described some years ago, people's choices around housing represent a trade-off between space, place, and price. The widespread shift to working from home reduced the premium on place. If you don't need to commute to employment centres as often, living further out becomes more tenable. It then becomes more feasible to get more space for a similar price by trading off place. A lower relative advantage of central locations will show up in their relative price. And that is exactly what happened. The relative premium paid to be closer to the city centre, both in rents and purchase prices, narrowed during the pandemic. I mean, housing prices increased over the 2 years to April this year across almost all neighbourhoods in major cities. But in general, price increases were stronger in the outer suburbs than in inner urban regions. So the premium for being close to the centre remains, but it's smaller now, and it's closer to the premium for being in a middle ring suburb. And you can see that by the change in the ratio and prices in this graph. Now, it should be noted that the desire for more space has probably been more widespread than the ability and willingness to trade off place. While a large fraction of the population has experienced long lockdowns, and more than a few of us have had to self-isolate, not everyone can make the location trade-off. Many people cannot work from home because of the nature of their work. ABS data show that more than 60% of managers and professionals were working from home in August last year, but only around 20% of people in the sales or community and personal services sector. And even those who can work from home at least part of the time will not be in a position to do so full time. The laptop class of people who can mostly work from home on an ongoing basis are in fact a small minority, a minority who prior to the pandemic were not evenly distributed across geography. Rather, they were concentrated in inner urban, higher priced areas. Data from the 2020 Hilda survey suggests that around 60% of people who lived within 5 kilometres of a city centre could work from home, but less than 40% of those who lived more than 20 kilometres out could do so. As a result, a shift in the location of some of the laptop class will be more noticeable than if they'd initially been more evenly spread. In considering the effects of the pandemic on the housing market, we need to remember that only some of these shifts might last. The desire for more space further from the office might wane over time as memories of lockdown start to fade. Not everyone who sought a tree change in the regions will find that to be the right choice in the long term. And more importantly, many of the shifts of population between location were less a change in people's decision than a simple interruption of normal flows. Now, in broad terms, the usual pattern of net population flows is that migrants from overseas are more likely to arrive in Sydney and Melbourne than elsewhere, and this net flow into those cities more than offsets the usual net outflow of existing residents to other parts of Australia, and especially Queensland. There are variations around this trend, such as the shifting net flows into and then out of Western Australia as the mining boom peaked and then declined. But these net flows mask much larger flows in both directions in every region. People move for all sorts of different reasons. Now, during the peak of the pandemic, some of these gross flows were impeded. As well as the flow of overseas migration coming to an effective halt while the international borders were closed, people from parts of Australia that were not in lockdown at the time tended not to move to cities that were in lockdown. So this wasn't so much about city people wanting tree changes, though I'm sure that was part of the story. Rather, it was a story about the interruption of the long-standing trend of others moving to the Big Smoke. Now, regardless of the source of the change in population flows, though, it is undeniable that in many regional housing markets, prices and rents have increased considerably. And this is impinging on the budgets of existing residents, and it is important to be mindful of that. With the inflow all but stopped and outflows continuing, population growth in Australia's largest cities over the last 2 years was much weaker than in the rest of the country. These shifts are now unwinding, with internal migration returning to a more typical pattern and overseas migration slowly starting to pick up. Overall population growth is now expected to revert to close to pre-pandemic patterns by 2024. It will take a little while for students and other migrants to return in the numbers that were seen before the pandemic. And importantly, official projections of population do not embody any catch-up from the period of closed borders. And this implies that the population level is on a permanently lower track than would have been expected had the borders not been closed. While the local market implications of this will be important, it's also worth considering the national picture. The sharp decline in population growth stemming from the border closures occurred at the same time as the housing stock continued to expand. Much of the additional supply will have been absorbed by the decline in the household size that I talked about earlier. But even so, the net effect is likely that the housing supply has for a number of years been running ahead of what would normally be thought of as trends in demand. Treasury forecasts imply that over time, population growth is likely to revert to something closer to its pre-pandemic rate. But what about the flow of net housing supply? Well, our expectation is that construction of new homes will remain solid for the next few years. The housing stock will therefore continue to expand as a result. That's the dashed orange line in this graph. We expect it will expand at rates similar to the first decade of this century, but not as much as during the boom in apartment building during the second half of the 2010s. But it's still likely to be enough to keep the housing stock growing faster than the population. Solid rates of home building have been encouraged by a range of public policy measures, including the low level of interest rates. Also important has been the raft of subsidies and other incentives for home construction, as well as support for home buyers during the pandemic. And in combination, these subsidies have been quite sizable in some cases, representing more than 10% of the average purchase price of a new home. Now, it's difficult to disentangle how much of the increase in demand for housing has reflected temporary subsidies and the current low level of mortgage rates versus the shift in preferences that we talked about earlier. However, it is clear that the time-limited nature of Home Builder and some of the other subsidies induced a temporary surge in building approvals for detached homes and renovations. We estimate that around one quarter of building approvals during this period were supported by Home Builder, although it's fair to say that some of those construction projects would have happened anyway. Even now, after eligibility for these subsidies has closed, these categories of building approvals have remained higher than immediately before the pandemic. This suggests that the extra demand induced by the subsidies wasn't entirely pulled forward from this year and next year. That would have left a hole in activity, and that hasn't happened. Rather, the combined effect of low interest rates and preference shifts is continuing to support demand. Over time, though, that additional surge in building approvals from Home Builder and other subsidies will have been worked through and will no longer be a support for the level of dwelling construction. But not yet, because as I'll explain, the construction industry is at capacity. Despite the surge in demand and building approvals, data on housing completions have not yet picked up in the same way. This is why current and expected growth in the housing stock is around the same rate as in the first decade of the century. The large number of detached approvals have mostly started construction. But as you can see in the blue line in the right-hand panel of this graph, there's now an unusually large pipeline of detached homes that are yet to be completed. All the signs point to the fact that the residential construction industry is at capacity and cannot work down this pipeline any faster. Now, I want to be clear. This has nothing to do with land availability or governments approving enough homes. It's nothing to do with those supposed restrictions on supply. The land has been made available. The building project is already approved. The issue is how fast these projects can be completed. We're hearing from our liaison contacts in the construction industry that delays are really common, and I'm sure this is an experience for all of you as well. Normally, a detached house takes about 6 months to build. Currently, our contacts are telling us that it's averaging around 9 months and longer in Western Australia. The divergence in the relationship between dwelling investment and its usual drivers is also suggesting that construction is at its capacity. Now, normally, dwelling investment in the ABS National Accounts can be reasonably well explained by factors such as recent building approvals, population growth, and interest rates. The red line on this graph is literally what the team at the RBA used to help them forecast dwelling investment. But lately, actual outcomes have been significantly weaker than those usual relationships would imply, and the accumulated difference, the accumulated backlog, if you like, is getting very high. Some of these delays relate to the availability of materials. The supply chain disruptions around the world have impinged on a range of building materials, especially steel and timber, but also everything from tiles to appliances. Around one-fifth of firms are reporting that the availability of materials is a significant constraint on their output. This is quite an extraordinary graph, if you ask me. This is far higher than we've seen at any time over the past three decades that the NAB have been running this survey. Based on the feedback from our liaison contacts, many of the firms represented in that red line are in the construction industry, including residential construction. Availability of labour is also an issue, especially in Western Australia, but this is not specific to construction. Now, it's worth noting that residential construction is also affected by conditions in other parts of the broader construction sector. Non-residential construction activity by the private sector is not unusually strong at the moment, but the pipeline of work yet to be done is at the upper end of its normal range relative to the size of the economy. The pipeline of planned public infrastructure projects is also quite large. Now, there are some inputs and skills that are specific to one sub-industry. There isn't much call for tunnel engineers or crane drivers in the detached homes construction sector, for example. But in broad terms, it seems that all segments of the construction industry are making a relatively large call on the same material and labour resources at the same time. So it's not surprising that the pipeline is remaining large, cost pressures are squeezing margins, and delays are longer than usual. That's a big part of the reason why we expect dwelling investment to remain high for some time, but not really increase any further as this pipeline is worked down. Now, over time, the short-term fillip to demand from home builder and the other temporary support measures will work its way out of the pipeline. As interest rates increase, the boosted demand from the current low interest rates will also wane. And the shifts in demand stemming from the pandemic will have worked their way through. As these more transitory factors wash out, what will this mean for the housing and construction markets? Now, the first observation to make is that prices will also shift, and this will both reflect and produce some of the adjustment in quantities. The cost of building a new detached home has increased markedly in recent quarters, and so has the price of the land it sits on. The combination of large rises in the cost of materials and the high level of demand represented by recent commencements has seen to that. Prices of existing homes have been easing in some cities, so the relative attractiveness of building a new one is reduced. The current pipeline will sustain activity for quite a while, but the backlogs and strained capacity will ultimately work themselves out. Now, exactly when that happens is hard to know. But when it does, we can expect some of the current rate of cost escalation and the squeeze on margins to ease. The second observation is that the decisions to rent or buy and who to live with are important margins of adjustment. Home builder and other subsidies lifted the number of first home buyers for a period. At the margin, this reduced the number of people wanting to rent. At least some of the people who moved out of share houses to live with their partner would have done so in a newly purchased home. Rents have been growing slowly for quite some time. And to be honest, this is not that surprising given that yields on other assets are generally quite low. Some rental contracts are probably still being affected by discounts offered earlier in the pandemic. In addition, the subdued level of rents paid was likely one of the factors that induced the decline in average household size that I mentioned earlier. There is, however, some suggestion that rents could be on the rise. Vacancy rates in Sydney and Melbourne have declined recently, and in other capital cities, and certainly in regional areas, vacancy rates remain around historical lows. Certainly, advertised rents, the red line on this graph, have increased quickly of late, though it will take some time to flow through to the stock of actual rents being paid. It's natural to focus on the opening of the borders and the resumption of population growth as potential drivers of higher rents. But it turns out that similar surges in advertised rents are evident in the United States and the United Kingdom, who didn't have the same population slowdown. Actual rents paid have been rising there, and in these and some other countries, such as Canada, CPI rental inflation, the stock of rents paid, is now running at the fastest pace in many years. And that's in contrast to what we see in the blue line in this graph. We aren't seeing this here in Australia, at least not yet. It is something to watch out for. Even so, if we do see a broad surge in rents here, we know that as with all these deep shifts, other things will adjust in response. In thinking about the landscape for housing, now that we're more or less past the acute pandemic phase of the health crisis and into the endemic phase, I'd like to conclude with a few observations and lessons to draw from recent experience. First, the importance of home and a sense of place has been emphasised by the experience of the past 2 years, and this could carry into the medium term. In predicting what this means for overall outcomes, we should consider what people do want in a home, not an idealised concept of what they ought to want. Second, policy really matters, especially in the short term. Whether it's time-limited subsidies bunching demand and boosting prices, or the interplay between low yields globally and rental yields locally, policy can have pervasive effects on housing outcomes. Third, everything has a limit, at least in the short term. We've seen this in the ability of global supply chains to supply materials, and in the capacity of the construction industry to deliver a volume of projects. When capacity limits are reached, prices can shift very quickly, at least until people find ways to expand those limits, or, as the next point highlights, until people find ways to stop pushing on those limits. Finally, we should be mindful that there are many margins of adjustment. For this reason, the medium term doesn't always resemble the short term. Whether it's a shift between flatmates and partners, renting and owning, or even short-term holiday rentals versus long-term rentals, the housing system does not stand still in the face of a shock. It is tempting to want to focus on a single outcome, such as the prices of established houses in particular areas. But a better question to ask, if a more difficult one to answer, is how the whole system will adjust. Thank you very much for your time.
Right, well, Lucy, thank you again. That was, it's the sort of speech that obviously you have gone and spent a lot of time specifically in this sector, and I, for one, I'm going to have to go and read it rather closely. But there are a couple of things I want to ask you around that, and then a couple of broader things, if that's all right. And I'd love some audience questions. So if I can repeat, it's slido.com in the URL, and then you enter hashtag UDIA, and then you can enter your questions from there. So looking forward to questions. Lucy, just on the housing market specifically, you talk about the construction industry at capacity and that availability of materials graph. I mean, it kind of says it all, over 20% of firms, you know, having real, real issues. You know, we're here, we see the trouble out there. As journalists, I see it. Are you confident the sector's going to be able to manage it through?
Well, I think in the end, people find ways to manage, and constraints are actually the precursor to creativity. A blank sheet of paper, no one knows what to do with it. But once you have a constraint, you start getting creative. Mm. I think, you know, the reality is the supply chain issues specifically are global. And in recent months, they have really intensified because of what's going on in China. And so, you know, we are seeing, you know, other, you know, disruptions. There were already disruptions right through the global economy, partly because of, you know, the pandemic and factory shutdowns, partly because demand had shifted from away from services, which people weren't allowed to consume under lockdown. And so people instead bought lots of goods, you know, whether it was, you know, setting up your home office or, you know, no longer going to the gym, so you buy one of those fancy exercise bikes. It's my world. You know, those are the things that have changed. And so there was a combination of a demand shift and supply disruption that's right. created those supply chain issues. Yeah. But that's only intensified because of the COVID outbreak in China and the government's response there. So it's really hard to say how long that's going to continue. So all I can really say is, you know, there were signs that certain things were getting easier in terms of obtaining materials. But I think, you know, there's a opportunity for creativity. I just want to make it clear that 20% is 20% of all firms.
Yes, not just the construction.
Yes, not just for construction. It's probably higher.
Yeah.
We don't know for sure from that survey, but certainly our liaison contacts are telling us. Yeah, absolutely. You know, they're really. You know, but there are ways around that. It's, you know, ordering more. I mean, you know, I'm sure many people have found, you know, just coordinating things is hard, and so, you know, this may well actually spur an improvement in, you know, how people coordinate project management, sequencing activities, parallel processing activities. I think, you know, yeah, there are certainly, you know, ways we can, you know, adapt to this by changing the way we work. And I think that's a lesson not only for the construction industry but everywhere.
So one of your messages today, I thought, was how important policy is for the sector. We've got a new government. We've got a shared equity scheme coming in for you know, first home buyers, young buyers. What sort of policies have had the biggest impact in your mind?
Well, I think what we've learned, I mean, we knew that monetary policy really mattered.
Yeah.
We've also learned that fiscal policy really matters. It was a very unusual 2020. We had the biggest contraction in GDP that we've seen since World War II. Unemployment went up several percentage points, and yet household income and small business profits actually rose. That's not what a normal recession looks like. That wasn't a recession. The government not only compensated for the income hole created by the necessary health restrictions, they more than compensated for that. And you know, we now have, you know, households saved a lot of that, but they spent a lot of it as well. We now have a, you know, household balance sheet that's very strong. You can have these pervasive effects. You know, there's $200 billion of additional saving that wouldn't have happened if the household saving rate had stayed where it was.
So you're talking about the broader fiscal policy, really?
Broader fiscal policy is really... Well, this is the thing, is I think it's the whole suite of policies. But obviously there are specific household housing interventions that have specific effects. But it's all, you've got to see it all within one system.
Yeah. So you were mentioning rates there, obviously. I think in a little while in New Zealand, over the ditch, we're probably going to see 2% cash rate coming through. I think they might peak at 3.5%. What's your outlook? What's the bank's outlook for a peak in rates? Could it get as high as New Zealand? Because that housing market, I think, has come off about 10% already.
Look, I'm not going to speculate about where it's going to land. We're going to, this is a very unusual period. We're in a world where inflation around the world has spiked and we've got very tight labour markets. And so you have a decline in real wages at the same time as a tight labour market. We really don't know. That's not actually happened before outside of, you know, there are a few episodes like Brexit where you had a big depreciation in the exchange rate. But that's not really a configuration that you've seen collectively across the advanced economy world. So, you know, how that is going to play out, I don't think it's really sensible to make a prediction because we don't, you know, we've got to be data-driven. You know, 4 months ago, 5 months ago, you know, we had a set of forecasts, but, you know, did we anticipate that Russia would invade Ukraine and what that would do to the price of energy around the world and how important that's been? So I feel like, you know, making a prediction in the light of so many events, just seems inappropriate. All I will say is that the board has already said, you know, there's more. There's more from here, but we will be watching the data and the evidence very carefully and working out what the appropriate course of action is.
Yeah. So 6 months ago, it was a different place. Obviously, the governor, very keen to encourage wages growth. Was when mentioning housing, if he did mention it, didn't seem that mortgage stress was high on the agenda. And in the last couple of months, I noticed he's talked about buffers and, you know, making sure that everybody's understands where they are. Really, I think is his implication. And I'm just wondering how comfortable you feel about the more leveraged end of the housing market and the buffers.
Sure, we've actually had that statement about making sure you have enough buffers in the monetary policy statement for quite some months now. That's something, you know, we've been thinking. You know, whenever interest rates are lower than they're likely to be over the longer term, you need to think about that. And the important thing is whether you have the structures and systems in place to ensure resilience overall. And so, you know, the fact that in this country, lenders are required by APRA to actually qualify people on a much higher interest rate than they're currently paying. And that's a requirement. In fact, that required add-on has been increased recently. So it used to be 250 basis points. Now it's 300 basis points. So, you know, when you go to your bank, they're working out whether you can service the loan on a much higher interest rate than what you're currently paying. And they're, you know, they're discounting certain forms of income. They may be assuming that you're willing to, you know, cancel at least a few of the streaming services you ended up with over lockdown. But they're making an assessment about your ability to manage your other financial obligations and the mortgage in very different circumstances.
But again, over in NZ, I mean, I think the RBNZ has recognised there's a lot of stress suddenly out there. You know, are we different?
To my understanding is they don't have the same, they do not have the same requirement. That add-on is not built into the prudential regulation. Right. I may be incorrect on that, but that's my understanding.
Yeah.
That's something that we've always understood. I mean, I think the other thing is, I mean, in New Zealand, they tend to have sort of 1 to 3 year fixed rate mortgages.
Yes.
So the issue of interest rates moving is far less salient to them.
Okay.
Whereas here in Australia, I mean, obviously recently a lot of people ended up with, you know, got into fixed rate mortgages for a while because they were, you know, they were, you know, very low rates and that would look very attractive. But we've always had a system where people are very cognizant that interest rates could rise and they, you know, they make those decisions accordingly.
Mm.
There will always be people, unfortunately, who, you know, have sort of an unfortunate outcome in their lives, whether it's a relationship breakdown or illness. There will be people who very unfortunately experience distress.
Yeah. But that is
but it's
part
it's
of the
separate
cycle,
from,
isn't it?
Yeah, the system is designed as best as possible to ensure that you don't end up actually causing a further problem.
No worries. I want to jump just a couple of last questions. Climate change. Now, obviously, you lost a former deputy governor to Twiggy. It is something I know that the governor and deputy governor were very engaged in. Mm. How do you see climate change now under the new government? Are there any risks in transition, the speed of transition? How do you see it?
Look, I think it really depends not only on the detail of the new government's policies, but the timing of them. And that's just something that is not possible to predict at the moment. I mean, you know, I wish Guy well in his new endeavours. I think it demonstrates the importance of that issue to humanity and the globe that he made that decision.
Yeah, that it's come through in the election. My last question, because I think we're sort of running short now, but some people are muttering about a recession in the United States, you know, by the end of next year. What do you think the chances are of that happening? And what's the knock-on effect for Australia?
Certainly they are muttering about it. You do hear this being discussed. I think the US is in a more difficult situation to Australia, but I think what it, again, it does demonstrate that policy really matters. In the US, they had a much bigger fiscal stimulus, and so they're now having to recalibrate. And one of the ways I like to sort of characterise the differences, you know, not only are they have a much, much higher inflation rate and the prices that are rising are much broader based than here. It's starting to become more broader based here, but it's nothing like what's going on in the US. Mm. But you know, while there is a lot of discussion here about labour shortages, if you look at the number of vacancies to the number of unemployed. Mm. At the moment, that's about 6 or 7 vacancies, getting up to 8 per, you know, per 10 unemployed people. In the US, it's more like 17 vacancies for every 10 unemployed people. They, you know, that's a genuine case where there just is a labour shortage. Whereas here, I think, you know, there is an issue of there's been a lot of change very quickly. There are vacancies, you're hiring, you know, you're poaching from another firm and then that firm has to poach from another firm and then all the way down.
But you think that between yourselves and the new government, you can manage this curly cat of interest rates and inflation?
I would hope so. I think we've demonstrated that policy really matters, and I think that sort of shared understanding that you need to think about both arms of policy will be much front of mind.
Mm. Well, Lucy Ellis, I want to thank you very much again for taking questions and also for, I mean, I know everybody was really fixed on what you were saying and those graphs up there, so thank you for taking the time to come here.
Thank you very much, Tiki.
Thank you.